Our speaker today is William Thuman. William was born in San Antonio, Texas in 1986, so he is a young'un, and he moved to Houston shortly thereafter. He works for Industrial Info Resources in Sugar Land, Texas. He's been working in researching natural gas technology and equipment for the past 5 years. William enjoys music, movies, reading, writing, and the arts. So there is your biographical information on William. But on a personal note, I've had the honor of knowing William, and I affectionately refer to William as Willie Boy, just because it drives his mother crazy. But he's my nephew, so I've known him for his entire life. He is the son of my younger sister, the only son of my younger sister. Will's a lot more than just my nephew, though. We spend a lot of time together. And over the last 4 or 5 years, I've come to know him in a very personal and profound way. I would identify William as a faithful, available, teachable young man. And so I am thrilled and honored to introduce William to you. So William, if you would please come up. I'm going to get here.
Clear, nice and clear, a little up. Try not to blow your eardrums out here. I thought I was going to have a Frank Drebin moment with this thing. I don't know if anybody gets that one, but Naked Gun. Never mind. You know. Well, as Rick said, my name is William Thuman. I'll have to reiterate this just in case you didn't get it. I was born in San Antonio, Texas in 1986. My family and I lived there for about 3 years when we moved to Houston. I was very young when I moved here, and I do have some very happy memories of the first few years of my life. My parents were both home. We had a happy childhood. I have an older sister who is here today. And we were taken care of as kids. And of course, we did kid things. We played and we watched, for me, it was watching Pee Wee's Playhouse and Fraggle Rock. And my sister, it was watching Bon Jovi. So we both, found things that we loved at a young age, and we didn't really have a care in the world. I don't have a lot of memories of this part of my childhood, but what I do remember are very fond memories. Now moving on, my parents divorced when I was very young. I was about 6 years old. I was too young to really understand why and what divorce was and why they were getting divorced, but I was old enough to know that things were different. They would not be the same after this. See, I know what it was like to have two parents at home, what it was like to have a stable, normal, healthy home environment. And that did change after that. I know my parents did the best they could, and divorce is very common in the world today. A lot of us growing up are multiple generations of broken homes, so there's nothing new about that. We each do the best that we can. But that doesn't change the fact that it did leave a profound effect on me. It affected me at a very young age. I saw for the first time that life wasn't always so good, and that sometimes bad things do happen. I remember being little and loving to tell stories, and I always had a very vivid imagination. But at this young age, I began to really lose some of that sort of childhood spark. And I know that, looking back as a 33-year-old man to a 6-year-old boy, I know now that I started to kind of experience depression, because my life started off one way, very certain, and I knew that when I, things were going to be one way and then things weren't. So that began to change. I also began to behave very differently in school. I would act up. I refused to do my homework. I just wasn't interested in school anymore. I lost interest in life. I also began to become a lot more isolated. I went to a private school until sixth grade. And from kindergarten to sixth grade, I would say I was in second grade when my parents divorced. And then after that, from second to sixth grade, I was still at the school. And those two different periods of my life were two different people. While I'm acting up in this private school, it's not necessarily the best environment to be misbehaving in, because they really know how to paddle you there. They also know how to make you kneel on pebbles with bare skin to really teach you a lesson. So that just kind of compounded my mistrust of adults and older people and people who supposedly cared about me in life. I just lost all trust for that and lost all interest in school. So I was always in trouble, and eventually I got used to this. Over time, my behavior just continued to be worse. It all compounded. I could not tell you at the time why this was the case. I only knew that I just wasn't happy in life. No one in this world can make me happy either. People were untrustworthy, and the world was mostly a pretty terrible place. So I would eventually leave the private school in sixth grade, and I would go into public school. I think that my parents thought that by doing this, it might change things. But I was already struggling with depression and anger, and really wouldn't talk to anybody about the problems I was having. I didn't trust people, and the evidence of this was really how I was going from a very happy, kind of imaginative kid to a very dark young man. So I was only in this new school for a very short period of time, probably about a few months before I really started making a mark on how much trouble I was going to be. I think I'd only been there for about 3 months when I got my first suspension, and this just kind of continued to go on. I think I was suspended from school probably at least once a month at this point. So I really started to get in trouble. I can still recall how many times my poor dad would have to be called away from work to come pick me up at school because, again, I got in a fight or, you know, I was just being a handful, and the principal decided, well, we got to call his dad because he's suspended and he has to come pick him up. So sorry, Dad. But the problems just continued. And again, as I said, I don't think I ever really did homework once. And it was around this time of my life, around 7th or 8th grade, that I was really first introduced to drugs. And at first it was just, you know, the kind of things that teenagers get into, and it was pretty harmless. But I found that for me, and the way that I was feeling on the inside, and how lost and dark I was feeling, drugs helped me to escape. And so I liked the feeling of escaping from what I was experiencing in life. And so from this point on, forward in my life, drugs really would become a nasty habit that would get a hold of me in a very significant way. And I was really ashamed that I was struggling with this problem, and I was struggling with depression, and I was struggling with all these things. And so this continued to fuel my anxiety, and would turn into depression. Then depression would turn into deeper mental health issues. Around 14 years of age, I also began to cut myself. My arms, my legs, pretty much anywhere I could hide it. This was kind of a habit that I really didn't understand why I was doing it at the time. And I was too young to really know that this was just a way of me, again, distracting myself from the pain and, you know, kind of confusion I was feeling in life. And one of the reasons why I never really talked to anybody about it was because I felt like boys didn't do that kind of thing. You know, boys are supposed to be stronger than that, more capable, and we're not supposed to be emotional. But my experience as a kid was that I was pretty emotional, and I was just stuffing it all inside, and so this manifested in that way in my life. So all this behavior to me, I knew was abnormal, but I decided it was best to keep it a secret. So I became a stranger. I never really felt like I fit in anywhere. At home, I was always in trouble, so I didn't really want to be there. At school, it was pretty much the same, always in trouble, so why be there if I'm just going to get yelled at by somebody? So by this point in my life, this is how I would describe myself. It would be unstable, insecure, scared, angry, and now I'm starting to go through puberty, and that's a very deadly storm at that age. So naturally, I would hang out with other kids like me, other kids who we shared a common bond of anger and hurt. And these kids were, you know, we were just attracted to each other because you could see it in our eyes that we all kind of grew up in broken homes, and we were all just trying to make it work in this world, but we didn't know what we were doing. So now you also have a group of angry, young, unstable men who are scared, and they're going through puberty, and we're all just rambunctious, and we have access to drugs and alcohol, and we're learning what parties are like, and we're learning that this keeps us away from our emotions. And so now you have an even worse situation on your hands, because what was once isolated, now I had a group of friends that could help me to advance the problems that were going on. So this is kind of how my life would go for the next few years. Really, if there was something stupid, dangerous, or rebellious that could be done, I would do it. And one of my goals in life was to do it even harder and worse than anyone. If somebody said, you know, set fire to something, I would set fire to something, then pour gasoline on top of it and jump through it. You know, if there was a window to be broken, not only would I break the window, but then I would jump through and roll around the glass if I thought that was a good way to behave. So it really, I think the reason I did this was because it gave me a sense of control in my life that I never really had. And one thing that I will say as a guy and an adult man now, I know that what we crave as young men is some kind of control. We crave knowing that our futures are secure, that by our decisions we're going to have a life that has more meaning and importance. But at this point, I just didn't see any of that. And so in a weird way, that kind of gave me importance and meaning. So eventually, by the time I was in high school, things had, of course, naturally only gotten worse. Again, I was suspended from school probably at this point, going from every month to about every week, or other every other week. And I wanted to kind of give a quick story of an example of a typical week at in my life at this point, and I'm going to try to go through it quickly. But I was about 15 years old, and some of these friends that I mentioned earlier and I were hanging out in front of a middle school, and we were just doing what we did, acting like 15-year-old angry young men with skateboards, and we liked punk rock, and we thought that was the coolest way to be. And we're hanging out in front of this school, and a police officer pulled up and said that somebody had called the cops and that we were acting disorderly. So at 15 years old, this was the first time that I ended up in the back of a cop car. And I thought, wow, what a great story I'm going to have for school. Everybody's going to think I'm such a badass. They're going to think, man, this guy really, look at this guy. He's in the back of a cop car. He doesn't care. But really, on the inside, I was afraid I was going to go to jail. And I was even more afraid that my parents were going to find out. And to kind of make this long story short, the way that my parents found out was the next week I was suspended from school for getting in a fight. And my dad, again, sorry, Dad, he had me go to work with him. So I went to work with him to pick up trash, and the police officer who arrested me the week before, who I kept a secret from him, he didn't know yet, showed up to buy a car, and he looked over at me and said, "Hey, you over there, didn't I arrest you last week?" That's how my parents found out that I was in the back of a cop car the week before. So. But that was kind of typical. That was just really one sort of drop in the ocean of situations that was going on in my life. So eventually, by the time I was 16 years old, it was decided that I would leave high school. And high school just wasn't working out. I really wasn't going anywhere with it, you know. Probably was only in school a few days of the year already, so it didn't really seem to matter. But that I would go into the military. So again, at 16, about partially through my freshman year of high school, I left and I got my GED. But at first I was resistant to the idea. I was presented with the option of which branch of the military I would go into. And at the time, I wasn't interested in going into the military. I thought, you know, that I didn't really believe that it would be anything that would help me, because again, I didn't really see anything in my life that would ever really make any change. But eventually, you know, as I kind of started going through the process, and I did really well on my ASVABs, and I was given very good options of what would happen for my education furthering my life after the military, I really fell into this, and I thought this was something that I could enjoy. So going to basic training, being sworn in, was for the first time in my life that I really actually felt proud of myself, proud of a decision that I had made. Up until this point, every decision I made just seemed to be tinged with some sort of damage control, but this was like, I'm actually going to do something good for once. So I lived so much of my life with uncertainty, and again, this was the first time I had a clear vision of where I should be going, what I would be doing. I was really loving basic training. This was short-lived though, because I was injured not too long into my basic training. That started off as a mild sprain in my left ankle and then turned into a third degree sprain. And the reason I point this out was because it kind of goes back to a problem I mentioned earlier, where I wouldn't talk about what was hurting me. I wouldn't share with anyone because I wanted to prove that I could do this. I had lived so long without any kind of real direction or any purpose that to go and say, "Oh, CC, I hurt my ankle," and then go to the hospital would make me look like a loser, and I didn't want to look like a loser. I wanted to look like somebody who had it together, which I didn't. No matter how clear it was to people that I didn't have it together, it didn't matter. I still wanted that sense of control. So again, what started off as a very mild sprain in my ankle turned into a real problem that kept me limping around for about 6 months to a year. So again, I'm hurting. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to face the consequences because I was afraid that I would lose the only thing that had ever, to this point, given my life any meaning. This, of course, was a mistake. And I have found that in life that what starts off small only grows to become worse. And this was the beginning of me starting to learn this lesson. I was sent back home with an honorable medical discharge, the Coast Guard allowing for 9 months recuperation. And if I got better, I would be going back in. I would be re-enlisting, hopefully, so that way I could continue my education and go to A school. So I still kind of felt some hope. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll recuperate, I'll get better, and eventually I'll go back in, and I don't have to live at home and drive my parents crazy and just kind of wonder about life as a complete hooligan. So at this point, I started to get a job and started to just kind of keep myself busy until I kind of found out what my future would look like. But after a few months back home, now I'm involved in a car accident. And this car accident was pretty bad. I was left with a torn retina, partial blindness in my left eye, and a mild concussion. And so, of course, that same week that I was in this accident, I had to call my recruitment officer and let them know, and that basically shut the chances of me ever going back into the military down. So, of course, this took away any chance of me re-enlisting in the future, and I fell into a very terrible depression, and I began to use drugs and alcohol more frequently. At this point, I'm 18 years old, you know, I've been back for about a year. And I have to say that the next year or two of my life is kind of a blur. I moved out of my parents' house. I was living with people where it was basically a nonstop party. We were surrounded by drugs and alcohol, and this part of my life, the only memories that I have of it are just kind of waking up and thinking, what's gone wrong with me? What's gone so horribly wrong in my life that, you know, this is the way that I have to respond to this, that I have to continue to be intoxicated so I don't have to feel what's really going on inside. Sorry. So I grew worse into my drug use, and I branched out many times into whatever was available. It didn't really matter. I didn't really have anything in particular or choice. Just take me away from the issues I'm having on the inside. Life had really lost all of its meaning. So I drifted around trying to find something that would satisfy me, and nothing ever really did. So eventually the drug use would catch up to me, and I would experience my first of a few overdoses. This wake-up call was not enough, though, for me to really decide that drugs were not a thing for me. I was really just on a path of self-destruction. If it hadn't been drugs, it would have been something else to be self-destructive in, driving a car down a freeway without my seatbelt on, trying to wreck it deliberately into the side of a bridge, for example. It could have been anything. It was just basically Russian roulette at this point. So going on, one night I was invited to a party, and I had already been kind of going for a few days in this lifestyle, and so the last thing I needed to do was go to a party where I could go get more alcohol in my system. So I would go to this party, and eventually I would get into a fight with somebody, and naturally that would be very politely asked to leave. So I would get up and I would go out to my car and drive away, and that's the last thing I would remember that night until I woke up in my car, wondering why it wasn't starting and why it was so dark outside. The best way to explain this was, you know, I'm waking up in the middle of the road in the middle of the night, and it's silent, and my car's not moving, and I have no idea how I got here. I don't remember anything. So I get out of the car and I decide to go walking down the road because I'm not too far from where I lived, and I have no memory of getting to this place. And I'm walking down the road, and suddenly in about 5 minutes I'm surrounded by about three different police jurisdictions, about 30 different cop cars, and it's just a mess. And they're all interrogating me, asking me what's going on. You know, obviously I'm the guy getting out of the car, and I'm stumbling down the side of the road. I'm very visibly drunk and high, and you know, there's no way you can really hide that from the cops. They're pretty good at figuring that stuff out. So I was 19 years old at this point, and again, ending up in another accident like this didn't wake me up. I ended up in jail, and you know, when I ended up in jail, I didn't really know what I was going to be charged with. But long story short, I found out that I was going to be charged to the best extent that the judge could charge me with, which was a felony, and I was going to be charged with an accident involving injury. The driver of the other vehicle didn't press charges. You know, thank God he wasn't killed or harmed. I blacked out in my car, and I had rolled right through a red light, and another car smashed into the passenger side of my vehicle. If it had been the driver's side, it would have killed me. So now I have a felony conviction, and you know, jail didn't wake me up. The felony conviction didn't wake me up. I had to deal with 8 years of probation after that. Obviously, living at home was not the best option. But, you know, I would have to move back and forth when I could find a job. I would be on my own and, you know, make that work out for a while. Then that wouldn't work out, and so I would move somewhere else to when I could make money to pay rent or something. So another couple years of this, and this is all still going on, and I'm on probation, and I'm still secretly trying to get by with my drug use and secretly trying to get by with drinking as much alcohol as I can, trying to make, you know, life work on my own. It's just not working, and in fact, it's getting worse and worse. You know, what I had a problem before with drugs and depression and all this stuff, now it's compounded with the fact that I'm a convicted felon and I'm on probation. Good luck getting a job. So really, the moments of clarity came with a harsh reality of how far I had sunk and how terrible my life had become. I hated myself at this point. You know, one of the things that really happened next in my life was, because I was continuing to use drugs, I would eventually overdose again. And the probation officer, of course, would find out about this, and I would have to go speak to the probation officer and kind of explain to them why I'm not really supposed to be doing drugs, but here I am overdosing. So thank God they didn't send me to prison. I would have been there for a while. But she gave me some grace and saw that I was dealing with the depression. So I would be diagnosed as bipolar and with suicidal tendencies, and the court would order me on all sorts of medicines and mental health evaluations and things like that. And they would basically monitor everything I did. So this continued to compound. And so really my life had no freedom. I had no future. I had nothing going for me. Up until this point, the only thing that I could point to in my life that had ever had any kind of meaning was when I went to the military. And now this is what my life looks like. There's nothing. There's no future here. So I really began to have a lot of depression and began to be having suicidal thoughts. This became kind of a daily thing, just as much as I would wake up in the morning and the first thing you would do is, I guess, maybe stretch or get out of bed. The first thing that would happen with me in the morning was I would think about how I was going to kill myself today. Because logically, in my mind, there was no other option. This was the only way to end things. So I made, eventually would deal with this for a long time. And so leading up until about March of 2009, I was 21 years old at this point. So the past 2 years have basically just been a blur of chaos, as you can tell. So I made an elaborate suicide plan, and I decided that if I was going to do this, I didn't want my family finding me. That's the last thing I wanted. So I was going to go find a river somewhere, and I was going to find every way to end my life and then make sure that I somehow fell in the river so nobody could find me. I wanted to disappear, and I only point this out because the point is I just wanted to cease to exist. To me, there was nothing beyond what I could see in front of me. There was no beyond. If I ceased to exist, everything would end, and it would be okay. It didn't matter. So I went to bed on March 12th, 2009, having decided that on March 13th, that the first thing in the morning when I was alone, I would walk down to the river and I would end my life. But something happened on that day of March 13th, 2009. Instead of waking up and deciding that I was going to follow through with this plan, there was a feeling that was beginning to kind of come up inside of me that I can't easily explain. Looking back, I understand what it was, but at the time it was a foreign feeling to me. I woke up and had a plan to follow through on, and I would need to carry through with it. But the feeling that was growing inside of me was like sort of standing in a room and suddenly somebody who loves you is looking in through the window and they're seeing what you're about to do. And you realize that they've seen your entire life, but this person that's looking in through the window still loves you. And so something inside of me was telling me that, how can I follow through with something that I've been planning out and I've been dealing with my whole life when this person's looking in through the window and for whatever reason they're loving something like me, this creature that I've become. So I do want to share this. Sorry, I was about to share a quote I should share later. My bad. Sorry. So I felt ashamed. Someone loved me, but there was no one there. You know, it was just me in this room. And so I began to think of my plan again. And then suddenly I kind of remembered some of the things I felt as a kid. Something that had existed away from the drugs and the chaos and the emptiness and all the depression. It was the reality that I was loved. This is what was coming to me. And so what I found myself doing in a moment was I really found myself beginning to pray. And I found myself praying to God, asking, okay, God, here's the deal. I really don't want to live anymore. This life has been nothing but just terrible. Why would I want to continue doing this? But just on the off chance that you are real and somehow that you love me, you're going to have to answer this prayer. I can't get better at home. It's just going to keep happening over and over again. I'm going to keep doing the same cycle I've been doing it my whole life. I need to get away from this. You have to answer me and tell me that you have somewhere for me to go to get better, or else I'm not going to make it. So really, that was kind of my way of first admitting to myself that even though my life had been so much chaos, that suddenly this kind of love that was looking in through the window was love of God. Nobody was there preaching at me. You know, I'd heard some things growing up in church, obviously, but there was nobody there saying, well, you need to give your life to Jesus. You know, if they had told me that on March 12th, I would have just told them to screw themselves, because I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't interested in giving another Christian brownie points for their life to feel better about. But March 13th, 2009, something completely different happened inside of me. It was not about what my feelings and my beliefs were. It was about me seeing myself for the wretched creature I had become. Me seeing the darkness that had been taking hold of my entire life and being tired of it. And if my only option was to end my life, if that's the only thing I could see, if that's the only logical conclusion, why is that the only logical conclusion that I have? And so for me, it was about reaching out to something else, and something transformed inside of me. I gotta move on here, sorry. So I finished up this prayer and the phone began to ring. And I had just been thinking about how the most important thing to me was to ask God to give me a place to go. And so the phone began to ring, and it was a family member. And this family member had been praying for me for a while and just kind of seeing this sort of chaos that I was going through. And I didn't pick up the phone at first because, again, I just assumed it was somebody who was probably, you know, pissed off at me for something, so I ignored it. But I heard these words on the answering machine. And they went, William, please pick up. I've been praying this morning, and I think that God is telling me to give you a call. I want you to know that I've been looking to outreach programs for you to go to, and that I feel like I have found one that you could go to. And I want you to know that God has a place for you to go. And so for me, in that very moment, a prayer I had just prayed 5 minutes before was answered in actual reality in my life. And so what began to happen was, from going from this place of darkness and this place of confusion and fear and nothing but death and destruction, suddenly I had an encounter that there was a God, that there was a God who was real, and that there was a God who loved me. So really, that's all I needed to hear. I mean, for me, I had been so tired of this life, and I feel like I had a lot of grace to be able to see my own wretchedness and to see how bad things had come, that it was easy for me to let go of all this, because why would I want to keep holding on to it when the reality that you are loved comes to you? Why would you want to choose anything else? So I immediately picked up the phone. I asked, what time are we going to go? And we decided then and there that I would leave. So there's a quote by Brennan Manning, and he writes this in the Ragamuffin Gospel. He says, the good news means that we can stop lying to ourselves. The sweet sound of amazing grace saves us from the necessity of self-deception. You see, the whole problem that I had been dealing with my entire life was the problem of self-deception, that there was no hope, that there was no future, that there was nothing for me, that I would never have any kind of life, so therefore I had to end it. But amazing grace was what saved me from self-deception and set me free and allowed me to have a future. So when I went to this place, I began to learn about a little bit more about amazing grace, and I'm going to try to get into it here. I think this is probably pretty important. Where are we at? We good? Okay. So Luke 15:4 says, if a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness to go to search for the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. See, this is what I was experiencing, not guilt, not anger, nor fear of going to hell or something like that. It was something deeper. And I was being carried in someone's arms, someone who loved me, had seen all I had gone through, had seen behind my curtain, and they were fully aware of how wretched I was and how without meaning I had lived my life up until this point. But they chose to love me anyhow. So one thing I've learned in reflection on this is that the love of the world is very conditional. We love when we do the things that please each other. We love whenever we feel that that person is making us happy, or we love whenever somebody obeys us, or we love whenever somebody does something for us. But what I was learning was that kind of conditional love is what brought me to the place I was at, because I had nothing to give, and nobody had anything to give to me. But the kind of love that comes from God is unconditional. He doesn't ask us to be holy. He doesn't ask us to be, you know, these amazing church-going people. When we come to this conclusion, when I came to this conclusion, I was a complete, broken, dark mess. So obviously, his love went beyond what I could ever really imagine. So anyhow, I went to an outreach program for men like me, and as someone I know puts it, it was the land of misfit toys. I really fit right in there. For the first time, I was around people who were like me, guys who had all kind of been outcasts, who hadn't really fit into society, guys who had dealt with drugs and prison and things like that. And I began to learn that, other people had dealt with this same exact problem that I had been dealing with, and so I wasn't alone. I wasn't a complete freak, and I could have people I could talk to about what I was going through. So we had all been changed from living life inside of a life-sucking black hole into something that's completely different. It brings life and gives light. And then I also began to read the Bible. I would begin to understand a very old verse. It's probably the first verse that a lot of us hear at some point in our lives. But if you haven't heard it, I'm going to share it, of course. It's John 3:16. For God so loved the world. But one day I read it this way. For this is how God loved William. He gave his one and only son so that William would not perish, but by believing in him, he would have eternal life. God sent his son into my world not to judge me, but to save me through Jesus. A lot of that's very confusing, because if you look at my situation, what does eternal life have to do with all the death and destruction that surrounded me? How could I even respond to that? And the only way that I could respond to that was by beginning to understand that God had enough grace to love me through my situation and to really reach down to me. So I began to realize what all this means and how amazing grace really is. So again, on March 12th, I would not have responded to the phone call. But on March 13, 2009, I had a direct answer. And moving on into this outreach program and growing up and kind of learning that I wasn't alone in all of this was just God continuing to show me how much he loved me. You know, he was showing me that he hears me, he sees me, he loves me, he doesn't want me to cease to exist. And he asked me to give me my burden and lay it down and that he would take me home. I had not really known home. I don't blame my parents or anyone else. I'm not bitter. If my life had been perfect, if I had been normal, if I had been an A student, then I still would not have known what home meant. Home would have been a place that existed by default. So where that was something that existed by default, it was now something that was really real, and I was finding that I had a place. I was not just some messed up, broken millennial, you know, trying to pick myself up by my broken bootstraps. Home was somewhere eternal that was prepared for me before I even existed. And that kind of blew my mind. And Ephesians 1:4 says, even before he made the world, God loved us and chose us in Jesus to be his holy and innocent and loving people. I was not holy. I was not innocent. I was not loving. I did not love. But something happened that chose me for that experience. And it's not the sacrifices that we can make in life. Me killing myself, other people killing themselves, other people giving everything they've got to try to be a better person, to try to be something more than what they are, never really fulfills the need that we all have as humans to have love unconditionally. You know, Matthew 9:11 also says, but go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Some of us, for me, I found that I was just really the worst kind of sinner. So it was kind of, again, like I say, it was a real grace to be able to see that, because it's all on the surface. It's not really hiding. I didn't have to look deep to see what my problem was. So I also began to walk with a man through discipleship, and now I'm meeting with men on my own. These guys are going through similar things that I've gone through, but I'm finding that I'm able to share my life and this stuff with them, and they're having some victory. I've had my ups and downs over the years. I've had a couple of relapses back into self-medicating, trying to do things my own way. That never really works out, and so inevitably I always kind of come back to this truth. I've learned over the years that when I do things on my own, things go south very quickly. I'm not angry or bitter about what's happened in my life, these things I suffered and put myself through. In light of these things, I'm being brought deeper and deeper into the arms of a loving God who didn't demand that I first become a pious and church-going Christian before I could see my life turn around. He first demonstrated his love for me and that I was a wicked creature hell-bent on self-destruction. But I have learned that even though this love is love of the world is conditional, again, I want to reiterate, his love is completely unconditional. Ephesians 2:4-9 says, so it is by grace we've been saved through faith and not of ourselves. And one thing I want to point out here, so nobody thinks that I'm trying to put up how self-righteous I am. Thomas Merton puts it this way. He says, a saint is not someone who is good, but someone who experiences the goodness of God. In my apparent nature, I'm not good. I have my struggles every single day. Yes. I still have missteps and sometimes attempt to take the reins of my own life. Yes. I try to be the one that's in control and have things go my way no matter what. But all along this narrow path, there is one thing that is constant, and steadfast and does not fade or change. And that is the goodness of God that a wretch like me is able to experience. The great writer and philosopher Dostoevsky said this of goodness and grace. At the last judgment, Christ will say to us, "Come you also, come drunkards, come weaklings, come children of shame." And the wise and prudent will say, "Lord, why do you welcome them?" And he will say, "If I welcome them, you wise men, if I welcome them, you prudent men, it is because not one of them has ever been judged worthy. And he will stretch out his arms, and we will fall at his feet, and we will cry out sobbing, and then we will understand the gospel of grace." Thank you.